Well, let us begin. Tonight we're going to attempt to get through the second half of the book, actually. Actually, a little more than the second half. But the first chapter in the second half of the book talks about the social world of Jesus, and I don't think I want to spend a lot of time on that, but just to mention it. And in that chapter, Borg talks a lot about the occupation of the Romans and about the double taxation that people faced, if you remember from reading that chapter. The Romans required, as I recall, been a while since I read that chapter, but it was something like 10 or 12%, wasn't it, of a person's earnings or their produce from the farms. And then the Jewish state required a tithe, or another 10%, so that if you were faithful to all of your taxes, you could pay as much as 25? It was even higher than that. I think it got up to like 35% or something like that.
So only the rich people could be faithful.
Right. The Jewish state had no real way to enforce their taxation. The Romans did. So the way that was endeavored to enforce the Jewish side of it was through the whole concept of holiness. If one was an observant Jew, which was equivalent to being holy, then in addition to paying one's Roman taxation, one would also pay one's taxation to the temple and the Jewish state and so forth. And if you were unable to do that, then you were considered to be a part of the unobservant, or the, I suppose, unholy people. And so Borg talks a lot about the politics of holiness in this chapter, and how that conditioned what it was like in Jesus's day and Jesus's time.
He really sets up the notion that that was a time of real social crisis.
Right.
That came through again and again, that they were just getting beaten by these taxes, and that the Jews sort of were feeling overrun and overwhelmed, and that their sort of survival mechanism was to get real righteous.
Right.
Pretty dramatic picture.
And so everyone that was unable to fulfill those obligations was considered a sinner or an outcast. And so there was naturally, in Jesus' time, a large group of sinners or outcasts. And they were kind of an identifiable social group of people. And so that's kind of the stage upon which Jesus enters and carries out his mission and his ministry. And there were, of course, a number of movements that competed for the loyalties of the Jewish people. And Borg claims that Jesus founded a renewal movement that was in competition with some of these other movements, like the Pharisees and so forth. Okay, so that's just a little bit about chapter 5. Then we move on to chapter 6, where I'd like us to spend more of our time tonight. And where the title of this chapter is Jesus as Sage, Challenge to Conventional Wisdom. And Bohr claims that Jesus was a sage, a teacher of wisdom, and was regularly addressed as teacher during his lifetime by his, not only his followers, but his opponents and other people. And then he says this, let me read you this paragraph and a half here. Some have thought that he was primarily a teacher of beliefs, or more precisely of what was to be believed in order to be saved, providing correct information in the form of divine revelation about God and Jesus' own role in salvation. Others have stressed that he was a teacher of a new moral ethic, whether understood as a new moral code consisting of highly specific commands, or as a set of more generalized ideals, such as love and justice, or the golden rule, or the brotherhood of man. But Jesus was not primarily a teacher of either correct beliefs or right morals. Rather, he was a teacher of a way or path, specifically a way of transformation. His teaching involved a radical criticism of the conventional wisdom that lay at the core of the first century Jewish social world. So that's the next thesis that Bohr's going to work at. He's going to say, he's going to assert that Jesus was not a teacher of, he wants to say, he doesn't say he doesn't teach beliefs, and he doesn't say he doesn't teach moral ethics, but he wants to say he was not primarily either of those, a teacher of beliefs about God or about himself, or he was not primarily a teacher of a new moral ethic, either in very specific terms or in general terms. What he was, in Bohr's view, was a teacher about a way or a path. And he talks some about how he does that. He says he did it largely through proverbs, parables, and lessons from nature. Now, like many teachers who taught a way or a path before him, Jesus also spoke of two ways or paths. And he called one the wide way or the broad way, and the other one the narrow way. Now, I'd like first then to ask the question, what is the broad way? And then we'll go into the question of what is the narrow way. Don't worry about whether you have read this chapter or not. What do you think Jesus would have referred to as the broad way? Or when you think of the broad way, what do you think of that refers to as contrast with the narrow way? We'll talk about the narrow way in a minute. What is the broad way?
Theater.
What?
The theater in New York.
Alright, the theater in New York City.
Interesting, they named the street Broadway.
Broadway, Park Place, and Monopoly.
Right.
I think it was the way of the culture.
Okay.
The way of advertising.
Okay.
You know, the allusion, the reference to Broadway reminds me of every time this winter that we've left the village, we've driven straight to Seattle. And there's always, you know, we do that last little stretch between Monroe and Seattle. It's always dark when we're getting there. And all of a sudden you start to come across the lights of the city. I mean, I always associate lights with Broadway too. But there's a certain excitement that wells up within me, like coming out of the wilderness into the city, and you start to see all these flashy cars, and if it's on a Friday, you see people going out on dates and having a good time. I mean, you just kind of imagine all this stuff, and there's something really seductive about that whole thing. I mean, it's very appealing, that way of the culture, the broad, light way.
A way that is more self-serving than to serve others or to seek God seems also the way of the culture.
Okay.
It also seems to be something where you don't make a choice. You just kind of ooze along.
It's easy not to make choices.
Yeah.
To let the culture
not even
do
a way that,
that
you're not even aware you're on a way.
And it's safer. Yeah. There's lots of room. There's no chance of falling off either side.
Mm-hmm.
There's people with you. It's not necessarily lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's safer for people that are good at it.
Right.
I mean, there certainly are folks that didn't fit into the Broadway either. But you can get a lot of feedback. Whether it's in secular terms, in terms of getting more stuff, you feel like you're a more successful person, or in terms of holiness, the way they're talking about, you know, if you tithe and do all these things, you feel yourself a better person for it. There's a kind of system of rewards.
Well, it's tempting to say that the Broadway is the way of the culture, but dismisses that view of anti-culture in the last chapter when he says what Christ was interested in was transforming the culture. So it isn't simply because it's the culture that it's resisted. That it's not just, it isn't simply because it's what being done at the time that it's wrong, because anything that would be done would be dominant in the culture would be wrong. So there's some other principle.
Well, in the last chapter, he talks about it was not Jesus' intent to remove us from the culture, but to transform the culture, right? And, okay.
Well, the Broadway would be that current that sweeps culture in that destructive direction.
Yeah.
It's interesting, sometimes people can think they're going against culture and they can be a culture themselves, so it can still be the Broadway, you know, where there's not really a conscious choice making or transforming. It's just being caught up in it.
Okay, now in contrast to the broad way, he talks about the narrow way. And what do you think would be involved for Jesus in the narrow way?
For Jesus?
Yeah.
Well, for Jesus, it was the cross.
Okay.
And, you know, that life.
What is
the cross like?
Yeah. All the way to the cross.
Yeah.
But what do you go to the cross for?
Right.
What are you for which sends you to the cross?
Yeah. The cross is a consequence of being on the narrow road.
Right.
Okay, he talks about One of the dimensions of the narrow way is what he calls the way of death. And Borg says, and Jesus spoke explicitly of the path as the way of dying. If any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. And of course he talks about this not only as, I mean, he's thinking that Borg makes the point that this is a metaphor, not necessarily a physical reality
for us.
for others. For us.
Before reading that chapter, I think I would have described the narrow way with sort of secretly, sort of terms of like self-denial, giving up a material possession, prayer, kind of hard stuff. But I think it's that section when he talks so much about the self-transformation and the change, really a change in of heart.
Right.
And that it's more of an invitation to the narrow way than a new rule. And that really changes the whole feel of it for me.
Well, all that stuff may still be implied, but that could very easily turn into another way of holiness. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have probably seen it as more like a Pharisee kind of thing before.
Okay, what else might be involved in this narrow way? And you can speak about it either from what you think Jesus would have thought it would be or what you think it is.
Well, Borg says in the last chapter, which is the one I've read,
and it's the only one we have,
that you couldn't possibly be a Christian today and be rooted in affluence, achievement, appearance, power, competition, consumption, or individualism. Vastly different from anything recognizably Christian, which you could assume then that...
Would you agree with him?
Yes.
I just had to ask.
Rhetorical question.
But the question is that what Jesus was against? That's the question I thought you were asking, and I don't know what Borg says Jesus was against.
Yeah, well, that's what he says.
Well, one of the things, you know, that piece about individualism that I found really helpful today, reading today, because there is so much emphasis currently in our culture about individualism, and some of that is good. And what I was reading in Borg, which was new to me, is the responsibility of each faithful person to undergo, with the grace of God, of course, a self-transformation. But that is done only for the ministry in the larger world. It's not ever done for just yourself. And right. That, to me, is then different from many of the voices in our current culture that don't go that step.
It is an individual act.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
He says that he uses this phrase, a new heart, for Jesus. One of the dimensions of the narrow way was getting a new heart. And that does imply an inner, very personal transformation. He says the tension between correctly following tradition and the importance of the inner self was a central theme in the teaching of Jesus. About some of the practitioners of tradition in his day, Jesus said, "This people honors God with their lips, but their heart is far from God." They said, and to a large extent did, the right things, but the inner self remained far away. What mattered was what was inside the heart. The things that come out of a person from the heart are what defile the person, cleanse the inside, and so forth. So, certainly there is a strong dimension of very personal inner transformation that Borg asserts is at the center of what Jesus called the narrow way.
And didn't he use the phrase once, secondhand religion? That if Jesus were against something, it would be the notion of secondhand religion, of sort of copying the outward acts of religion that maybe you learn from your family or your community group. But until that enters in and changes you, you won't have that new heart. And,
well, I've always made a distinction between actions and feelings. You can act right, but you don't feel the feelings of other people. You don't really experience the pain and the suffering and the sorrow. And but you know you ought to do something, or you ought to respond in a certain way, so you do.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't feel it, and I don't know what you can do about those feelings. Either have them or you don't. And it's still good, I think, to do some of these things. And Aristotle said, if you do a good deed often enough, you become, your whole emotional life becomes attached to. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I believe it enough to think it's a wise thing to do. To do things that you think need to be done, even if you don't feel them, in the hopes that someday you'll feel them.
I know sometimes in therapy for people who are depressed, you know, they are told to get up, you know, be bright, cheery, smiling, even if you don't feel like it. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the day, you will really feel like it. Because if something that happens, even though you are falsely smiling, that it does something to you and you become, your smile becomes real. And so it changes you. So if they practice that, they become a changed person and they can work out of their depression.
What?
So practicing is good.
Yeah, go ahead.
My view of what Jesus was talking about is the opposite of that. I mean, he talked about the kingdom is starting out real small and growing. And he talked about, you know, knowing us by our fruits. And always pointing inside. That for me, Jesus's philosophy was that you don't change the inside by acting on the outside, but by a choice, God changes the inside, or you both change the inside, then the outside acts true to the inside. Because he always talks about, you know, cleaning the inside of the cup. Because the Pharisees certainly did the outward righteousness, at least they followed the tradition. But even in doing that, the important things were left undone because they weren't right on the inside.
But in the parable of the Good Samaritan, it's the person who does that is applauded, and there's no discussion about why. Is there?
Well,
I mean,
you can
go backward and forward on this proof text thing.
But I think it's probably, I would say that it's assumed, given the other kinds of stories that Jesus taught. He says out of a person's heart.
Yeah, and I don't think Jesus talking about having good feelings.
No, I don't think it's
much
the feelings.
Deeper than that. I think it's how you see the world, how you're moved by the world.
Yeah. But feelings are very, very deep. I mean, I think myself that the world is feeling. And that everything feels in the world, and it's a question of the depth and the dimensions of feeling. And in feeling, you become a part of somebody else. You feel the other person's feelings, and they become you, and you become them. So I don't think feeling it's not just emotion, it's a much deeper thing than emotion.
Yeah. Okay.
Much deeper.
That our words more define them.
Yeah.
I think the point that Borg wants to make is that he perceived Jesus suggesting that if one interpreted what it meant to be religious was an outer performance of what one's culture thought it meant to be religious, then one never got in touch with where one really is. And he's gonna say that the third dimension is being centered in the spirit. Mm-hmm. But just to follow this line of thinking here, and if one can never get in touch, if one's religion does not somehow come out of oneself, then one can never be in a position to be a critic. Or one could never be a part of a transforming process in one's society, because one is bound to perform whatever the culture of the society says it means to be religious.
I think you even used the word snare at one point.
Snare?
That it could just snare you into, you know, perpetrating the conventional wisdom.
Right.
And that you can't get below or beyond that.
One is there's a sense in which if one stays with that, one is simply at the mercy of whatever. Now maybe you get lucky and you're in a tradition where, you know.
The word that Ford uses to summarize all this is compassion.
Right.
Is that one becomes a person of compassion.
Right. Right.
And that's the depth that I'm talking about.
Right. We're going to get to that in a minute. That's in the next chapter.
The last chapter, yeah.
That's right, I'll read the last
one. The one we can read.
I was just thinking of an example in my own life of my mom, who dutifully got us, mom and dad, but I was thinking mom, got us to Sunday school, and she even taught little kid Sunday school for a few years, and it was later on that I began to realize how incredibly painful all that experience. She hated teaching Sunday school. She didn't believe in what she was doing. And I think, truth be known, she really was pretty uncomfortable going to church most of those years. And how much better off she would have been, and I think I would have been, had she done whatever she needed to do to let God's Spirit speak to her, because it wasn't going to happen in the Episcopal Church for who knows what reasons. But she was so uncomfortable. But I think she very much needed to be a church-going person and have her kids go to church, and it didn't bear good fruit in some way.
Right.
Our oldest daughter gave a testimony at a church one time, and somebody told me about it afterwards. Wished that we had been there, but she spoke in reference to her father's faith, and she said, "I thought I could go to heaven on my father's faith."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "One day I realized it had to be my own." And it was a very beautiful tribute. That was so enriching to know that she had moved into that recognition.
Well, in talking about this struggle between the broad way and the narrow way, the first point that Borg makes is that the dimension of the inner way is this reception of a new heart, and we've been talking about that.
Mm.
And he says the conflict is between a way of being religious that depended upon the observance of externals, a way of conventional wisdom, and a way of being religious that depended upon inner transformation. Indeed, this conflict is found in all of the major religions. Thus, according to Jesus, what was needed was an inner transformation of the self at its deepest level. "Blessed are the pure in heart," he said, "for they shall see God." What is needed is a new heart, a pure heart, for such a heart produces good fruit. And then he goes on to the second thing he says is a dimension of the narrow way, and he calls that centering in the Spirit, or centering in the God, or beginning with God. No, that's Al Pitcher's term. He says that the central concerns of the conventional wisdom of his day, meaning Jesus' day, were family, wealth, honor, and religion. Those were the four cornerstones of the Jewish culture. Not a whole lot different than our culture. But they were rival centers, which is, I hadn't thought of that before. And Jesus' family, wealth, honor, and religion, to a certain extent, rivaled one another. His criticism of them was a call to be centered in spirit and not in culture. And I had to think about that for a while. So something needs to inform this transformation. It's not just an empty transformation for the sake of transformation, but something has to inform this transformation in order for it to be.
What does he say it means to be pure in heart? What do we think it means to be pure in heart? Pure in heart.
Clean coronary arteries.
Cholesterol.
Wish everyone well. What does cure in heart mean?
Well, what does it mean? What does pure mean? What does the word pure mean to us?
Of one kind, not diluted.
Okay, focused. All right.
I'd say focused on God, seeking what God wants us to be about.
All right.
Loving God and neighbor.
All right.
Pure in heart would be to wish to focus on God and on neighbor.
With the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind.
I don't think a pure heart is how to put this. I think when Jesus talks about a pure heart, I think he's talking about the end of the road. Scott was talking about, you know, what needs to be changed is the heart of a person. And I think that change, the culmination of that change is a pure heart. I think that's sort of the goal, the destination.
Right?
Rather than a prerequisite. Yeah, rather than a
prerequisite. Hmm. Because you don't get that instantly, you get it after much seeking, well, much effort.
I always felt that it takes a lifetime for God to change us into what we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, he uses the proverb of the of nature. You get figs and grapes from a fig tree and a vine, not from a thorn bush or a bramble bush. But when this common sense observation is applied to the heart and its behavior, it became radical. What matters is what kind of heart you have, that is, what kind of tree you are. And you cannot change the kind of tree you are by dealing only with the fruit. In other words, you have to deal with the heart. That would be like trying to change a thorn bush into a fig tree by hanging figs on it.
Love that. That's a great picture.
You have to change it by what seed it comes from.
Yeah, what kind of tree. That's sort of what outward religion does, doesn't it? It hangs the trappings.
So the heart has something to do with what he's calling a deeper level of the self. What you're all about, your being. What are those words you use now with such passion?
Well, I've always thought that you can be a little self or a big self. And what God is trying to do is to transform us into big selves whose interests and concerns and feelings and passions and hopes and dreams run out to the ends of earth and the ends of time. That's just where I'm at. And how you get that transformation is a miracle. Because some people have it, other people talk about it, preach about it, and almost obviously, although you never can tell, don't seem to have it. It's a miracle when your being is such that you're just overflowing with concern for everything and every being. And of course, now you've got to add nature too, and for the creation.
So you have to be willing to open up yourself to that.
Well, it's obviously, you see, for Jesus, if your feelings were running out like that, you wouldn't care too much what you ate or what you drank or what you have or what possessions you have or what status you have, because you'd be so concerned for kind of what's happening to people and how can their lives be more meaningful and fruitful and alive and less destructive
Right.
So that all this other stuff would be secondary, which he says. I'm just quoting Jesus now. And so you'd have a focus on being, as Hall puts it, being for, with, and in communion with everything.
bottom line of all this is that Borg claims that therefore Jesus was interested in transformation. He was interested in the transformation of the individual and thus the transformation, ultimately, of the culture. He calls him a transformative sage, as opposed to being a subversive sage. He wasn't trying to subvert anyone or subvert the culture. He was trying to transform the individual and thus ultimately transform the culture.
Let's see if I understand that. If he were to subvert something, would that tend to set up sides, cause division? Whereas he's trying to transform a whole culture.
Yeah, you know, I suppose, what? Right. If you were another power, if you were another center of power, mm-hmm. wanting to take over the culture, then you try to subvert the culture in order to mm-hmm. take over the culture. But his emphasis was not that. His emphasis was on transforming the individual and thus transforming the culture. And that's why, you know, his ultimate statement about Jesus is this business of a revitalization movement founder. Big language. At least that's the way I interpreted that. Okay, well, let's go on to that, because that's the next chapter. Jesus as revitalization movement founder. and the whole key to that, the movement, the Jesus movement, the movement was grounded in the spirit. Sometimes renewal movements come into existence simply through a strongly perceived difference between how things are and how they ought to be. But often the vivid spiritual experience, conviction of a particular individual, is also a major factor. The Jesus movement clearly belongs in this latter category. It came into existence in part because of the crisis facing Judaism, but also because of the spirit-filled experience of its founder. And then he goes on and says that the central factor, I guess you'd say, in the movement, the thing that the whole movement is built on, or this revitalization movement is built on, is the notion of compassion. As the image of God. And he talks about compassion, the politics of compassion, and compassion for, you know, various groups, being a peace party and proclaiming release to the captives and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about compassion. Borg's assertion is that that's the heart.
Or the uterus.
Well, the heart, yeah. That's the heart. There's another heart, right? Or the uterus, right?
The birth place. Was that
yeah, he said that
Hebrew or
the
Aramaic?
Hebrew word for compassion is the plural of the Hebrew word for womb.
Well, that's right.
God is a womb.
That was in the chapter before.
That is interesting.
The Hebrew word for compassion.
Well,
that's
the
piece
of,
yeah.
Is the.
Yeah.
It's, I don't. What
plural
part?
The Hebrew word that Jesus uses for compassion is the plural of the Hebrew word for womb. So in other words, if we said wombs, the implication would be compassion.
So when Jesus spoke that word, when he was talking to people, Well, he didn't speak in Hebrew, though, did he?
Yeah, he wasn't.
He was speaking Aramaic.
Spoke Aramaic. And we don't
so I was wondering what image the word compassion brought up for people in that culture, in that time.
The word Jesus used most often to identify this quality of God was compassionate. It has particularly rich resonances in Hebrew and Aramaic, where it is the plural of the noun womb. Thus, compassionate bore the connotations of wombishness, nourishing, giving life, embracing. Perhaps it also suggested feelings of tenderness. God is nourishing, life-giving, wombish.
Where are you? What page?
That's page 102. That's back in chapter.
So that would have been the imagery people would have had in their mind when he said that word.
Nourish, it gives those adjectives.
Nourishing, life-giving, wombish.
In the previous sentence you read, it didn't use the word wombish, but it used one other.
Wombishness. Thus compassion is more the connotations of wombishness. Like a womb.
What were some of the other adjectives?
Nourishing, giving life, embracing. Feelings of tenderness.
Feelings of tenderness. That down deep into our hearts.
The claim that God is gracious lies at the heart of the Old Testament.
That's a point that I think or expressed, it certainly left out at me, and I guess that this point is contained in the word revitalization, that I haven't thought about it, is that that means that you're drawing on an old tradition, you're finding the resources in your tradition for renewal rather than starting fresh. And that Bork says that again and again, that Jesus reached back into the Torah or whatever to... He didn't come up with the notion that God was compassionate or that God was womish. That was embedded in his culture, and that he was just reminding people again, hey, let's think of it this way.
Yeah.
Plus, the immediacy of his spiritual experience, and those two things together were really powerful.
And I see he's going to set up for us another duality here, which I think is fascinating. And that's the tension between the politics of holiness and the politics of compassion. And I couldn't help but think about some of the letters that Susan and I have been getting. And Kitty. That talk about how we cannot associate ourselves with. In other words, we're being accused, because of our kind of stand and solidarity with gay and lesbian people, at least providing them a forum, to share their concerns. And we get all these letters. I mean, we get, two, a couple a day of late.
Really?
And saying, take us off the mailing list. We cannot support,
All I'm saying is people. Awareness Week,
right.
And they read so much into
right. The
word awareness.
Quote all these Bible verses.
Yeah.
They do not want to associate themselves with
the
unclean.
Mm-hmm.
You see. Now maybe this is obviously this is very judgmental on my part, but I'm just telling you how I see it. I mean, that feels to me very much like a politics of holiness, as opposed to whether you agree or you disagree with that lifestyle. That still that approach feels to me like very much a politics of holiness, as opposed to politics of compassion, where you may not agree, but at least you have, compassion.
But would we not say if people are not compassionate that they are less than what they ought to be, or less than what they're called to be? Or would we reverse it, in other words? Would we want to have anything to do with the church?
That's what you're asking.
Which really wasn't compassionate with regard to gays and us.
That's part of the narrow path, isn't it? Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
That's part of the narrow path.
You mean that would become our form of holiness? Is that what you're saying?
To make
that
choice.
Oh,
all I'm saying is, don't we reverse that holiness, and it's just a different substance of holiness.
I misunderstood you. Okay.
Sure, well, that we could be very guilty of that, right?
That then we become the holy ones?
Yeah.
By saying these people aren't.
Right.
We're compassionate, and other people aren't compassionate.
Yeah.
So we're compassionate about exactly what they're doing.
Right, right.
Sure.
We're all justified by grace.
Right. Well, I guess that would depend on whether we stop showing compassion towards the people who weren't showing compassion.
Right.
Yeah. Are we writing a compassionate letter back to them? I think we are.
We'll have to go and see if our letter is compassionate.
I need to read your letter.
Yeah, I'll give you a copy.
Right. But don't feel proud about it, because that'll ruin all of it, right?
Right.
I like this paragraph, which I thought kind of summed up. I mean, he goes on and talks about Jesus as prophet and so forth. And at the end of that, when he's sort of summing the section up, page 164, indeed, the call to change was at the heart of his various roles. As founder of a revitalization movement, he created an alternative community grounded in the spirit. He also talks a lot about community in these chapters, Al.
Well, the last chapter says there are two important things, compassion and community. Our spirit, I mean, a spiritual world in this compassion and the formation of a community.
Right. He created an alternative community grounded in the spirit, whose purpose was to provide an alternative cultural path to the politics of holiness. Much of his teaching was concerned with that movement, describing its shape as the community of compassion, and defending its shape in the face of questioning and opposition from others. He basically makes the point that he understands Jesus' return to Jerusalem as he thinks that what Jesus had in mind was a prophetic mission to call his people again to kind of a, you know, make a final appeal at the center of their national and religious life. Not to fulfill a preordained destiny, but to call people to this community of compassion. And in the process of that, I mean, he ends up, you know, getting killed. He also said, I learned some things about Pilate I didn't know. He's talking about this, you know, who killed Jesus question. Obviously the Romans crucified Jesus. He also suggests that from what we know about Roman policy in Palestine and Pilate's character in particular, it's completely conceivable that the Romans alone were responsible for the entire scenario of arrest, trial, and execution. The portrait of Pilate vacillating during the trial and finally giving in to the Jewish authorities is completely out of character. On the other hand, he said it is entirely possible that since the Caiaphas, who was what? The
high priest
served for 18 years, all during Pilate's term, and served at the good graces of the Roman governor, that the two could have easily been in cahoots, and Jesus was perceived by this small group of elitist Jews, the political Sanhedrin, as somehow a threat to them, and so, you know, he arranged with Pilate to have him crucified, or have him killed, executed. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of Borg says he was not simply a victim, but one who provocatively challenged the ethos of his day. He was killed because he sought in the name and power of the spirit the transformation of his own culture. That which killed Jesus is thus still alive in human history. The conflict between him and his opponents was between two ways of being that run throughout the history of Israel and through human history generally, including the church and modern culture. One way organizes life around the security of the self and its world, the essential ingredients of conventional wisdom and a politics of holiness, even if in a transformed and secular form, are still very much with us. That which killed Jesus is thus still alive in human history. The other way of being organizes life around God. Ultimately, it was the conflict between a life grounded in spirit and one grounded in culture, and Jesus' own concern to transform his culture in the name of the spirit that caused his death. As the voice of an alternative consciousness shaped by the spirit, he called his people to another way. I'm going to have to go back and read this book and read all the footnotes. I think the footnotes are fascinating. Yeah. One would take, you know, twice as long to read the book if you read all of it.
One thing that keeps coming up in the footnotes that I wonder if we have in the library is Abraham Heschel, the prophet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have it.
I think it's in.
It used to be anyway.
Because he is that a lot in his.
Very good book.
Is it?
Actually, it's two books, isn't it? Yeah. Two volumes.
Yeah, I think that's
He Borg essentially sees Jesus as what he calls an epiphany. That's in the conclusion. Is that the chapter you read now?
I read the conclusion. I always read the last chapter first ordinarily, but I did read the first part of it.
Yeah. The epiphany of God. I thought that was an interesting statement.
I haven't read that.
The epiphany of God. He talks about Jesus as a disclosure or revelation of God, an epiphany of God. He did not only reveal God only in his teaching, as if revelation consisted primarily of information, but in his very way of being. The epiphany was Jesus, his person, as well as his message. As such, he was an image of God, an icon of God, revealing and mediating the divine reality. What he was like, therefore, discloses what God is like. I really like that last that little bit there. Then he also talks about Jesus as a model for our own discipleship. And again brings up the whole issue of compassion. It's in that section where he talks about Jesus not as someone who wants to escape culture or run away from culture, but one who wants to transform culture and do that through the politics of compassion. And thus he kind of ends the book on that note. Taking the vision of Jesus seriously thus entails seeking to structure the life of society in accord with the politics of compassion.
No, I need the appropriation of what you were reading tonight. It came that he wanted to escape. I mean, he was escaping everything.
At a certain point, yeah.
When he was king.
Yeah.
He wasn't doing anything about it.
Well, and even when he became tinker for a while, he just asked questions. That was it.
Let me end then just by reading you the very last, page 200, the very last, third to last paragraph. The themes also threaten our comfort within contemporary culture. The historical Jesus, with his call to a counter community with a counter consciousness, including consciousness of another realm and Lord, challenges the central values of contemporary American culture. Our quest for fulfillment seeks satisfaction through greater achievement. I already read this, some of this. Consumption and enjoyment. Our security rests in nuclear weapons, and our blindness and idolatry are visible in our stated willingness to blow up the world, if need be, to preserve our way of life. We as Christians are called to become the church in a culture whose values are largely alien to the Christian message, to be once again the church of the catacombs. So, I hope our discussions have intrigued you enough to go on and finish. If you haven't had a chance to read this, I think I still would say that this is the best book on Jesus I've read in recent years. Jeanette still has copies in the bookstore.
Do that discount prices.
So thank you all for your participation. Any final comments about it?
Yeah, I still want to know if Jesus died for my sin.
Because that's what you learn in Sunday school. I have never been able to, that has never entered into me and made a lot of sense. And Borg makes a picture of Jesus that is incredibly rich and is an epiphany for me. And I feel like it's enough. So the whole notion of Jesus dying for my sins and the sacrifice for us still is out there like a dangling participle for me.
I'll deal with that next Sunday in my sermon.
Stay tuned.
I really will.
Oh, good. Well, there's one.
I always say, when people say that, I say Jesus died primarily because of our sin.
I'm comfortable with that.
We hear it though all the time, don't we?
It's
part of
the word.
It's part of our doctrine.
Mm-hmm. It's part of the theology of the sacrifice.
And the first, you recall in the first chapter he talks about, that's the most popular view of what Jesus
had. No, that's necessarily the one Jesus had of himself.
No. Right.
It's the one that we kind of developed.
Right.
It's very post-Easter, very Paul, Paulish.
Yeah.
But the question is, if it has been kind of blown out of proportion, is it still valid in a proper proportion?
Sure.
Yeah. That's part of the...
Because I don't think that... At the beginning, I don't think that Borg is saying that that's wrong. I think it's more a question of proportion.
Right.
I don't find a conflict in it.
The question is, what you mean died for your sins? What does it mean?
Yeah, what does it mean?
It really depends on what your image of that is. If it's to appease an angry God that you're separated from because of sin, and God demands a blood sacrifice, that's pretty pagan, that's the kind of world that Jesus came from.
Yeah.
But
if God cares for you and you break the covenant in terms of compassion, what it says to me is Jesus declares by his death and by his whole life that you're not separated from God. Because you sinned.
He declares a restoration of the covenant.
But God forgives.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesus said that by his life, too.
That's what I
said.
By everything Jesus was, he declares. And I will say Sunday that what Luther says is that you are freed from the condemnation of the law by Christ's death and life and resurrection.
See, and I can't get.
But
that.
You're not free from the law as a directive. Mm-hmm. But that law no longer stands in the way of your relating to God. And we used to say here, life is new every morning.
But what I'm getting from Bort is that that's been in the Old Testament from time immemorial.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that did Jesus really bring something new, or did he just call us back to the roots of our faith?
Whether it's new or not, I think it's immaterial.
I do too, but our church is based on the fact that it's new. Mm. And the whole notion of,
well,
Sarah brought that up.
Certainly a lot of the Old Testament is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
I mean, that's there too. Yeah. Right. You can't deny
there
that.
Also, it's a question of lifting out one of the traditions and emphasizing
yeah.
it.
Covenant theology, the covenants in the Old Testament. The children were called to obey the covenants, not to achieve God's favor, but in response to God's favor.
Right.
And that's, those two different kinds of ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
And from what I can understand from studying Old Testament history and stuff, the Jewish temple religion slowly over the centuries got that switched around,
mm-hmm.
where you obeyed the law to achieve God's loving kindness. And that's where it was sort of that in Jesus' day, and Jesus is calling you back. Which is the role of a prophet. Which is the role of a prophet,
mm-hmm.
to call people back to the pure faith or whatever.
The way I do look at it is the way that phrase began to have new meaning for me. Jesus saves me from my sins. If you meditate on that phrase pretty deeply, Jesus embraced, because of Jesus embraced evil and taught and lived a path that rescues human beings from their sins. Al said it a moment ago. How did you put it? They're no longer bound to the law or something?
Condemned.
And you're no longer separated permanently.
Condemned.
You're permanent separation.
Right. now, that is a different statement than saying, if I believe certain things in my mind, magically all of my sins are taken care of. That's a different statement than saying, Jesus' life, which includes everything he was, including his death, was a process that saves people from their sins.
Because they too can go through that process.
Right. It isn't that we don't, because Jesus went through that, shows me that it's possible for me as well
to
be rescued from that.
But you still have to go through it.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that because he did it, you don't have to.
Right.
That's the part.
To go through what? I'm kind of missing something here. You still have to go through it, but what's it?
To follow the path.
You have to choose.
Okay.
Well, that gets into the willingness to die.
Yeah.
If you use Borg's terminology here, not just thinking Christianity has become a religion about Jesus,
right.
rather than Jesus' religion.
Yeah.
And I think what Jesus was interested in. Jesus was interested in having us be involved in his religion. And I think Borg is trying to lay out what he thinks Jesus' religion was here. In his categories and terms.
He said so that we can take seriously what Jesus took seriously.
So we can take seriously what Jesus took seriously.
That's right.
Be about what Jesus.
Which to me feels really different than a notion of a God who decides to send his son into the world to be sacrificed. That's what Sarah held up for me. That that's kind of a macabre God to do something like that. That's really a struggle for me to hear it that way.
But see, that's the heritage we come out of.
Right.
Christianity developed into a magic, you know. Well, it was this drama that you described, and if you believed it, then you were magically.
Yeah.
That was, the, you know.
I can remember the tradition I was brought up in. The process of being saved was, I believe, Jesus died for my sins, and I accept him as Lord. Bam, you're saved.
Yeah.
And
they
you see,
run around wondering, why am I not different?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, people would get they really hurt, you know, because sometimes the Spirit comes in and does some really good stuff right at the start.
You see, then there's no reason to take seriously the demands of God.
No.
I mean, if that's your theological persuasion, Al's going to tell us next Sunday, you're freed from the law, but not from the demands of the law.
You still have to love your neighbor.
Free from the condemnation.
You're free from the condemnation of the law, but not the demands of the law.
Condemnation means you are permanently separated from God by your acts.
Thrown into
shield. I don't think there's any way you can get. I just wrote to one of the members of our community. I said, I can't imagine anything you would do which would separate me from you personally. But I can imagine some things which will separate me from you institutionally. That is, as a member of our community. But personally, that is, God is not going to be separated, but there are some demands, and there are demands, and there are consequences of them.
But it was helpful for me just to actually, I had to go through the process of kind of throwing out that phrase, and then coming back to it and listening to it again.
Which phrase?
Being saved.
Yeah.
Save Jesus.
And then if I could get to that third level, then it, all of a sudden the light bulb went on, and I said, oh yeah, okay, now I think I understand, but I didn't. But see, that's we have such a Christian psyche, which is not the religion of Jesus. I mean, that's a whole lot of stuff that was developed later on, I think. I mean, that was, Paul had a big influence in that. And
sometimes they say that Christian churches based more on Paul than on Jesus.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of Greek thought,
Gnostic thought. It seems so simple, too, when you get back to it. It seems so very basic.
Yeah.
Here's Jesus. Here's what he was like. We want to be like him. We want to take seriously what he took seriously. Doesn't that sound easy? I mean, it's not easy, but it sounds simple to understand.
Well, it's simpler for my mind.
Than an abstract phrase of he died for our sins.
You know, what helped me a lot was looking at that word saved. You know, what that has come to mean to me. If you go through a basket full of apples, you save the good ones. And, you know, and the ones that aren't any good don't have any use. And I think the whole process of being saved is so God can look at us and say, you know, you're worth keeping. You know.
Well, we're all worth keeping, don't you suppose? I mean,
even though I am not Galatians 5.
Heck yeah, right.
What's Galatians 5? Mm. All these things that I am not, I'm full of anger, you know, lacking of love. And I thought when I became a Christian, I would change. And for years, I couldn't understand why I hadn't gotten rid of these things that I don't like about myself.
All right. Al talks a lot about, he loves this word being, you know, our whole
your essence
being, and you know, what is it?
The heart is very close to being.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I say, when you talk about the, what's your heart like, that you're talking about what your being is like.
Okay. What does it mean to really rescue our being? To save our being, to what? I mean, you can think of all the words you could use. Now, we generally, I mean, I grew up with the notion of what it means to be saved as something that had to do with life after death, largely. That's what this was all about.
But you do have to get rid of your sense of guilt and separation from God and separation from your own potentialities because of what you've done.
Right.
Or you will destroy yourself. You will become an addict. I mean, that's our whole understanding of addiction is.
That's what being saved means for me, is getting away from that guilt and realizing that.
Not that you're not guilty.
Right.
But it's no longer separating you from your potentialities and from God.
It's not something that's going to be granted to us when we die. I have it right now. And I think Pastor Lunder had said at one time, in God's sight, right this moment, I am as holy as Christ. And that is so breathtaking.
Holy as what?
As holy as Christ in God's sight.
Oh.
And
I thought you said whole as grass, and I
It was a long time before I could say it out loud, because it's, and even now it's hard to say, and I may not feel it, but I can believe it.
Well, I think God sees the end result.
Right, because...
And I don't, we're still in the process. I tend to really, for myself, really focus on the not being saved, but becoming saved.
Well, if I focus on this other, it cleans me, and it frees me of that part of me that I do not like, and it makes me more capable of even becoming a little bit more like what I would rather be.
I guess that is guilt-freeing.
It's just,
That's where we have to pay the proper attention to the preposition in that phrase of being saved from our sins. I think we, you know, our sins can have us, the guilt, you know, from our, in that sense, we do need to be saved from our sins.
Yeah.
We so often hear, traditionally, we have heard in that, we need to be saved from God because of our sins. That's the kind of fall redemption thing.
Yeah. I think when, years ago, I used to, you know, and I'd attend the same sermon, listen to the same sermon, and I'd come out feeling so condemned, and Ed wasn't condemned at all. And I couldn't understand why. You know, why? Because everything I heard was down, down, down. Everything he heard was up, 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 in the same words. And I had to accept that graciousness of God in order to be able to hear what Ed was hearing in the same words.
The womishness.
The womishness.
The thing that's exciting to me about our conversation is, and about what Borg has done for us here, and this whole kind of way of putting together, it means that for me anyway, what Jesus was up to then becomes not a matter of belief or disbelief, or it becomes a matter of whether I want to get serious about taking Jesus seriously. And I can believe all I want about Jesus, but that's not the issue. The issue is whether I'm going to choose personally to take seriously what he was up to. And I really like the way he deals with some of the tough issues in there at the end. I wish the Christian community as a whole, I would hope that that's kind of what we're about at Holden anyway, is trying to figure out what Jesus took seriously. And then asking each other, provoking each other to consider, you know, how seriously we're gonna take it, and I think that's quite a different kind of setting than a lot of discussions I've been involved in past years, where the issue at stake was what one believed about Jesus. because you can talk about that all night and all day and not take Jesus seriously or take Jesus seriously.
So you're putting action to mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's a way to it's a way to cloak mm-hmm. the responsibility, at least in my experience. Yeah.